Okay, I will start.
Easy enough.
Okay, I will introduce myself. My name is Dimitri Gangard, and presently I am working in the Laboratoire de Physique Théorique at Orsay, near Paris, and I am going to talk on spin waves in 1D spinner Bose gases. It was a recent project we've done with Jean-Noël Fuchs, who is presently at Innsbruck in the group of Peter Zoller. Tassilo Kailman was doing his pre-PhD stage in our group when we were at Ecole Normale at LKB, and all this project was done by under guidance of George Shlapnikov. So, first of all, I'd like to just remind what is the general setup for my favorite one-dimensional system of atoms. So we have a very, very elongated trap, and it can be characterized by three basic length scales. One of the length scales, which is related to the trap geometry, would be the transverse confinement length, just given by the transverse frequency of the trap. And we put the particles in such a way that the mean distance between them is 1 over n, and n during my talk will be one-dimensional density, linear density of particles. And since the particles are interacting, and we assume three-dimensional short-range potential with a scattering length A, A is a three-dimensional scattering length. And as I said again, the trap is very elongated, and the transverse frequency is such that the transverse motion of these atoms is completely frozen. It's a ground state of one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. So under some if the frequency is such that this inequality is satisfied, basically that means that the transfer frequency is much smaller than the chemical potential of this gas in any regimes, which I'm going to discuss later, then the system is basically one-dimensional. It's one-dimensional interacting system of bosons. And if, moreover, we assume this condition, the interaction potential in 1T would be also short-range, as has been shown by Maxim Olshany in 98. And the coupling constant on this potential will be given by this expression. So we are basically now, I summarize this relation between the length scales. Under this condition, the Hamiltonian of my system, I have written it in first and the second quantization. Well, in first can be written like a sum of kinetic energy of n particles and interaction between them. And this is the famous model. We got a famous exactly soluble model in statistical mechanics of one-dimensional bosons with delta potential interaction.
Question?
Here, just a moment, here I'm writing this same Hamiltonian, the second quantization, and for the moment I don't assume a spin of these particles, but actually my talk will be all about the spin and I will show it later. Yes?
So two questions. First of all, how does this differentiate from the criteria for the 1D regime of the Gross-Podievsky equation? Explicitly. And then,
yes.
Secondly, this interaction strength, I mean, it looks like you just have the usual constant, and you essentially change the units. I mean, if you wanted to take the Gross-Podievsky equation, you would integrate out over the transverse degrees of freedom, and you would get that. So I didn't see, you put that on Shani, but I didn't see anything about you know, the scattering length can go through, is this thing in the denominator, the scattering length, so it can go through infinity.
Oh, right? Okay, okay.
So I'm a little confused about the regime you're actually in. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. First of all, this condition is sufficient to have 1D regime both for gross Pitayevsky, but moreover, for strongly interacting, strongly correlated tones regime. And this, if this satisfied, it's 1D everywhere. The second point is, yes, I mean, actually, it's poor Smann or shiny result because doesn't have any geometrical resonances. Basically, it's if we assume this condition, the Alshani's expression comes to that. I mean, we say that basically what we have here is a scattering length, three-dimensional scattering length, much smaller than the transverse confinement. So, and the resonance comes about when these two length scales become comparable.
So this. This is both the gross Pitayevsky 1D regime and the...
It's a quantum mechanical, it's a many-body problem, and it's 1D regime, just confined.
I just want to be clear, because I've often written in papers this criterion for the GPD 1D, quite similar to this.
And yeah, it should be the same. It can be modified a little bit, because then there are... Here it's more general than GP. I assume it's more general than GP.
You can still have n times g, either large or small compared to one, can't you?
Sorry?
With all these conditions satisfied,
yeah.
You can still have the product n times g, either large or small compared to one.
Yes.
Which would distinguish between the atomic scale.
Yes,
and
yes, exactly. But I need this condition. If this condition is verified, you can have. But in any case, it will be 1D.
Am I right, just to continue what you are saying, that actually under the first under the condition of first non-equality, the second one is not that important. It's basically about how to calculate the effective interest.
Exactly.
But once you can
exactly.
Do it by solving, say, two-body problem, you can forget about the second condition and just write proper constant G. Because basically your first
right.
condition says that you have two-body physics in terms of effective interaction.
Exactly.
And then you just write your Hamiltonian, whatever G is.
Exactly. Thanks. Okay, and recently I've been doing some work related to the system as calculating the stability properties, calculating local correlation properties, also low energy behavior of the system. Just let me remind you the physics, basic physics at zero temperature, which is one is distinguished here at two main regimes depending on the interactions, which can be put in this dimensionless form. Gamma is basically the ratio between the potential energy and kinetic energy. And it depends on the ratio of the coupling constant G to the density. And in 1D, there is a remarkable result that as smaller density is, the stronger interactions are. And this is a little bit counterintuitive, but what happens in 1D is that particles cannot avoid each other. So in 1D, interactions are very strong, and this dimensionless coupling constant can be calculated just using the fact that kinetic energy has to be calculated in some kind of fermionic approach. The particles are confined by interactions to be in an interval of order with the mean interparticle distance. Yes.
I still don't understand that in relation to the criterion you were on the first slide, which was A much less than L naught. Because if A is much less than L naught, then
yes.
Particles can avoid each other. They can go right past each other, right? So they're not really
avoiding
each other. Avoiding when you completely avoid 3D.
The one dimensional.
They go past each other. There's not avoiding.
Again, if you just write down the Hamiltonian, it's already 1D, and then just in a line, the wave function has to decrease when two particles meet each other, and in 1D you have no more room. I mean,
I agree completely with Hamiltonian. I'm only talking about the criteria that you wrote down at the beginning.
Yeah, that criterion was just to describe the interactions at short range. And under the other condition, you're already in 1D, so you have no room.
I thought it should be the other way, that A should be on the order, or larger.
Lincoln's puzzle is that if A is so small, then it seems to be contradictory, the fact that you cannot pass through each other. However, this is a low energy theory. So you're talking about very long wavelength, and then basically when the density is very low, then the larger than the this whatever range interaction, then it looks like a hard core. That's all. This is effective theory. It's not. I mean, if it goes very high momentum, then they eventually can go through each other. But then the one is not in the quasi 1D regime.
What does high mean in this case?
High means would be the transverse frequency.
So that means that you do need a chemical potential of the system, much less.
Yes. Yes. And this was my first condition.
That means the system as the first condition.
Yeah. Yeah. So, depending on this dimension coupling constant, whether it's small, we have a Gross-Pitayevsky regime, which is described by physics very similar to what one has in 3D, except for the fact that we cannot have a long range of diagonal order. So we don't have really a condensate, but we have rather a quasi-condensate. The phase order gets broken at large distances. It's characterized by typical length scale, which is the healing length, basically. And on the other side, when we have a strong interactions, and here the system is pretty much described by the mean field, depending on what quantity you calculate, of course. But many, many properties of the system can be inferred from the Bogolyubov theory. On the other side, we have a very strongly interacting regime. And what basically happens that if I look at the wave function of, let's say, two particles, in this regime it goes to zero when gamma goes to infinity. And in the extreme case of gamma equals to infinity, this wave function vanishes when two particles are at the same point. And this led to an observation by Marvin Girardot in the 60s that this system can be mapped exactly to the system of non-interacting fermions, except for the proper phase has to be chosen, because the wave function is still symmetric, which is imposed by the fact that we are dealing here with bosons. So, and for this kind of regime, we have some correlation functions directly just equal to those of non-interacting fermions. That includes all the density correlations, including the spectrum of excitations. While the phase correlations are different just because of this sign, which is different between bosons and fermions. But anyway, this regime is characterized by this nice word, fermionization of the system. Okay.
There is no transition.
Yeah, this is a crossover. Yeah, no transition. Okay, so now I would like to just give to include spin in this description, and I'd like to just discuss briefly that recently there has been an interest in experimental interest in observation of spin waves in dilute ultra-cold gases. And here it's not one-dimensional system, of course. It's quite elongated, but not 1D. And it was experiment in Gila group in 2001, which was kind of presented as a puzzle, when we have two internal states. It was rubidium-87 atom, two hyperfine states. And if you have choose only two of them, it can be effectively described as spin 1/2 system. And what was observed in this system was a kind of relative oscillation of one component state A and the second component state B during the time. I mean, like what the experiment was to bring the system into superposition of two states and let it go for a while. So, for example, the component A was going to the edges of the trap and then coming back after some time, while the component B was just concentrating in the center and going and relaxing back. And it was identified by three subsequent PRL publications as a overdamped spin waves. And well, so there, this can be observed and was predicted many, long time ago by Bashkin and Mirovich. So now the all my talk would be just what can we calculate, and moreover calculate exactly for this exactly solvable 1D system, the dispersion relation of these spin waves. Like now, suppose this system becomes really one-dimensional. So what are the properties of the spin waves? This is the main question of my talk.
He was waiting for you.
And if there's something very important missing, I'm waiting for Jorge, so like I have a very good excuse.
But would be possible just tell us what was the punchline is so we will go on to like easier.
Ah, the punchline. Yes. Ah, okay. This the dispersion relations of the punchline. The dispersion relation of spin waves in 1D system, well, can be calculated exactly using the Beta-Ansatz solution, and the exact calculation shows very strong dependence of the what I call effective mass, because the spin waves are have basically quadratic dispersion, so it's characterized by the prefactor, which is inversely proportional to effective mass. So effective mass gets very, very large in the Donc-Girardeau regime, and it follows from the exact solution, and that leads to a very interesting observation of the excitation spectrum, for example, in a trapped system.
Can I then ask the question? Because so basically, I'm considering the case of essentially finite damage. Am I right?
No.
No, because you were setting the results about spin waves.
Yes. Yes.
In 3D, the spin waves, generally speaking, occur at high enough temperature, even in the Boltzmann regime.
No, yes. This is exciting. In the experiment, they deliberately excite the system. So
I know, but that's my question. So in 3D, we are dealing with the case of essentially finite temperature, and the book by Bashkin was dealing with
yes.
the Boltzmann gas, and the observations right. in spin polarized atomic hydrogen were dealing with essentially Boltzmann gas. I'm afraid that you were discussing a different situation, the situation of low temperature limit when there is spin charge separation in 1D, and this is a completely different story in my opinion.
You don't have to be afraid. I'm just saying that these spin waves are can be observed, and there are some reasons.
So
I'm not trying to reproduce the data. Are you?
No. What data? this one? No, not at all. It was a completely different story.
Okay, spin waves in the low temperature limit.
Exactly. Basically, yes. Yeah. Zero temperature limit.
You're right. That's above TC. That data. I mean.
Yeah. This one is even not condensed.
It's well above. It's Boltzmann.
Well above. It's
two times above TC. It was two
times.
Two times.
TC or something.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Well,
yeah. The situation is different.
It can be 10 times or 100 times above TC because the only condition which is necessary in
the experiment.
No, I think it must be sufficiently cold.
Okay.
To have the ultra cold collision, you have to be sufficiently cold. But that's true that you have to, you can be still above TC. But the situation now from now on it becomes purely theoretical. So I'm just maybe I will write I will
yeah,
put.
I will ask you. You said for spin one dimensional system you can solve it. But this is only for spin one half. It's two components. So you cannot solve it.
I think you can solve it for any spin if I, well, I never
actually,
tried
it's
that.
It's only one spin interaction primate, essentially. It's a spin 1/2.
Beta and Zatz can be solved for any number of components, as far as I know. The problem is that it's very complicated.
No, because for spin 1, you have to fine-tune parameters. I mean, generally, it's not solvable.
Okay.
So it's
SU2. Okay. So we have a situation when if my scattering length between different components are all equal, and this is pretty much the case of rubidium 87, as far as I know, then the Hamiltonian in first quantization still has this form. The only thing it changes is the symmetry properties of the wave function. And okay, so this is my Hamiltonian, and
is
I'm.
Is it 3D or 1D?
It's 1D. Of course, it's 1D. There's no vectors.
G, define G somehow in the form of 3D. Coupling where A is the 3D scattering.
I'm sorry, yes. Kind of. Yes, it's a 3D. No, forget about this. I mean, G is a G. It's given by.
It's all good G,
yeah. I mean, it's related to that in 3D, and this is the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So,
this is U,
colored
U, this one, then G is related to U.
To what? To me? Okay, so we have a system of n particles living in a one-dimensional world. We have each particle spin, it's spin 1/2 particles. And what is known about the system, first of all, it can be exactly solved. And for example, the ground state is very simple, because the ground state, as has been shown rigorously by Eisenberg and Lee quite recently, is fully polarized. And the total spin, in this case, would be just number of particles divided by 2. And then it just reduces to the old problem of Liebig-Linniger in 63 to calculate the ground state energy and all the thermodynamical properties of this. I mean, at zero temperature, like correlation function, potential energy, whatsoever. Okay. Now I'd like to discuss briefly the excitation of the system.
The interaction is
and then, actually, what I was trying to say here by this fake G is that basically interaction. Here, yeah, it's a symmetric G.
Replace all the A by G's.
Sorry?
Replace all the A's by G's.
So G is the only one constant, so it's spin symmetric. And in this is the result for the spin symmetric interactions, of course.
Yes, the problem is why the ground state, the different spin states are adjacent lifted. The interaction
doesn't. Oh, it's very simple. It's just because of the. It's basically that the wave function has to be symmetric, it has to do with the.
Oh yeah, in the trunk gas.
I mean, you're assuming
there,
I guess, that the coordinate space
wave
function is symmetric.
Yeah. This is the best situation. I mean, this argument by Eisenberg and Lee basically based on the kinetic energy of the ground state. That and this works in any dimension, by the way. This is the result for any dimension. And it's very general. It's even does not assume a two-body interaction can have many body interaction. Well, so we have excitation spectrum which consists of two branches. One are the phonons, when the spin doesn't change and I have just density waves in my system, characterized by the linear dispersion, and C here is the sound velocity. while the other branch of interaction, and this phononic spectrum is pretty much well understood on the basis both, on the basis of Betanzas solution plus the effective low energy hydrodynamical bosonization Luttinger liquid Haldane's approach. I will return to that later on. The second branch are the spinons, the spin waves, like lousily represented like here. And for the spin independent interaction, it should have the quadratic dispersion relation. And this dispersion relation is characterized by the effective mass M star. And this effective mass must be certainly depend on interactions. So this is my the main question, whether how this effective mass depends on the interaction. For example, we know that if one assumes the weakly interacting quasi-condensate Gross-Pitayevsky regime, the effective mass is very close to the bare mass of the system, because in the zeroth approximation, we have just two decoupled modes. One is the Bogolyubov phonons, and one is it looks like just one particle which is not interacting with this mode, and it must not change. We will see how some correction can be calculated in this weakly interacting regime. Yes.
Normally, the total number of each component is conserved. It's a good quantum number if we introduce two components. So basically, you are saying about some global ground state. But we can ask a question: what happens if we just introduce two components with given densities and with given number of particles, and these numbers are conserved?
Fixed magnetization.
It's a reasonable statement of the problem, because each number is conserved. And we can ask the question, what's the ground state?
Yes.
That's probably you and cooking all back in my last
year. In principle, yes. But it's just a typical statement of the problem. So I guess the result will be basically the same. You will have two modes. One mode will be with the linear dispersion relation, and another quadratic, as always.
It depends.
Situation even in 3D.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was, I think the problem can be stated this way. The only thing which bothers me, suppose you're in the highest, total spin zero state, for example. Then turning one spin, you basically lower the energy, right? So you're.
It's another statement of the problem, but I would just state the problem like I stated. Just I fixed the total number of components.
Yes.
I allow something.
So then basically you have only phonons, because if you do not allow to change spin, you don't have spinons, right? So you have to introduce it in some.
I'm not sure, because it's just an elementary excitation. I can always generate it in this or that way.
It depends. Here, what I'm speaking are just exactly this.
The
S equal one excitation.
The density of, for example, when the global density is constant, but the density of each component varies. That's the spin value.
Then spin waves do exist.
Absolutely. I can just. Basically, special redistribution of two components.
It is a very different problem, and it is the Boris is asking. Suppose you by hand fix the magnetization of the system.
Yeah. I see.
It's pretty predictable.
then in that case, then you would be likely to get a fragmented condensate. I think. Suppose you get that. Suppose for one reason or the other, you fix M sub Z, and then that just M sub Z. So that in particular M sub Z equals zero. And then so you have a magnetization x y plane, but then you also then suppose you average out, you don't know where the spin is, so therefore you end up with two up and end up with two down in the Fock states. Now then the excitations about it would be very different. With the you can have density mode each one of them, and you the spin in here, you don't know where they are, and then so it's a different situation.
What the problem is?
No,
it's absolutely clear what the spin wave.
Boris is, I was asking.
There is a generalization of this problem, which is quite relevant, because in a real experiment you can just have a conservation of each component independently, which means that you just put n large one and n large two numbers of particles in the system, just cool everything down to the zero temperature or whatever, and see what happens. And my point is that even in this case, you will have two modes. One is sound mode corresponding to the density wave, and another one is spin of pseudo-spin wave with this quantum dispersion relation.
Yes, it's the same as relative oscillations of two modes.
Absolutely, that's what I was saying. Exactly. Even in 3D.
Yes, in 3D, 2D, 1D.
Okay. Whatever D, yeah?
Yeah, but when you say... I think when you have M, it simply means it's polarized, it's not along the z-axis, yes. It's still polarized. It's sort of tilted at an angle, the internal field causes...
Is it just, what you mean, is it just changing the total spin or changing like, changing just the z component? Because if you change a z component, that basically the same system. I mean, it's if you change only z component, it's the same.
Look, Dima is not talking about that direction.
I mean, the direction in which the spins are polarized. By the way, I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mention it, but the direction along which the spins are polarized is completely arbitrary here.
No, I know.
It's not in. I mean, along some of particular components.
Yeah, because if the,
so I don't.
If the interactions are equal to each other. Then there is a symmetry. Yes, I can say
it's
I have all particles polarized, or I can say 50% are polarized like that, and 50% like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
It means simply that I rotate the polarization axis.
Okay.
It doesn't matter absolutely.
Okay. But the projection of this z-axis is a constant of motion. So if I fix it, it remains fixed.
If the three direction constants are equal to each other, you may rotate the polarization axis. You may put it in any direction, and it doesn't matter.
Okay, maybe you guys stop not asking questions, but rather, I mean, okay. So now, from now on, it would be more technical. I don't know. Well, I will. I must say that myself, I'm not very easy with the general solution of the system for two components. What is basically happens is that to solve this Hamiltonian one looks at a particular arrangement of the coordinates and assumes periodic boundary conditions. So we have this particle living here on the circle of length L, and there are n particles, and assumes this general ansatz for the wave function, which is given by a sum of the permutation of n coordinates x, and it's characterized, it's defined by the pseudo-momentum Kp, and try to solve the Hamiltonian. Well, when one puts this function into Hamiltonian, basically one has to satisfy boundary condition when two particles meet each other. And for that, we have the relation between this amplitude A given by the scattering matrix. So finally, if we have a total spin n over 2 minus m, where m is a number of reverse spin, my amplitude can be written as a certain function of n pseudo-momenta k and m kind of spin pseudo-momenta lambda. Is that must be, I mean,
you wouldn't succeed. It's very technical.
Well, it's quite technical. I mean, this is the very short paper by Young in 67. Actually, it's a three-page PRL, so this guy is solving this problem. And, okay, I have some idea. Basically, what you do without the spin, okay, I will show another transparency. I have prepared a couple of other transparencies to explain this result. So basically, the idea is the following. You have, again, this relation between the amplitude if two particles cross each other. It's given by the scattering matrix. And in the case of spin, or in a general, let's say in the general case of multi-component system, you have a direct term and exchange term. Like if you interchange two particles going one to the other with the momenta k1 and k2 and being at the present stage at x1, x2 and having their spin different, then you can have just two particles passing through each other or exchanging their spins or momenta. So these are two terms in this S matrix, and P12 is basically the operator which changes coordinates of these particles. Now, if the two spins of this particle were the same, then we could have the following situation. If I don't have spin, or basically the same spin, indistinguishable particles, if they're indistinguishable then and bosons, then this permutation operation just equals to 1, and we have this famous Leibniger scattering matrix. It's just a scattering from the delta-like potential for the particles. For fermions, we would have P equals minus 1, and then basically the scattering matrix equals to 1 up to a minus phase, which reflects the symmetry of the wave function. So it's easy. When you have spin 1/2, you have to specify where are on this line spins with this turned spins, and then have to somehow solve a Heisenberg chain on top of moving particles with different momentum. This is what's called nested betanza. Okay, what is more interesting is that the many-body scattering of n particles can be factorized in terms of two particle scattering matrix, and this basically the key for the solvability of the problem. And this was basically a solvable problem, integrable problem, and 1D basically relies on the fact that of factorization of the scattering matrix. Okay, but technically speaking, we have finally Betanzas equation for these parameters. They come from the fact that now we have to satisfy periodicity conditions, and these are equations one has to solve in order to find the information about the energies of the system. One has n quasi-momentum k, which are interacting, I mean, it's a nonlinear interaction between them and interaction between k's and lambdas, and the same for lambdas, something like that. Okay. Energy can be calculated in the usual way, I mean, like if k were really, really momenta, like sum of the squares of this momenta, and the total momentum is given by basically by the sum of the k's, and this solution depends on quantum number i's and j's. It's quantum numbers basically labels the level of my many body system, like n labels the level of harmonic oscillator. It's just set of n integers I and set of m integers J. Okay, these equations, by the way, are I'm not going to the thermodynamical limit, and I keep n and m finite, and actually it can be solved quite easily on the computer, and just by some iteration technique, and this is what we also did. Okay, so now here you have some results for the ground state is a Leibniger problem. So these integers are arranged as in the case of free fermions, and solving this nonlinear equation for the case and calculating the energy gives the energy spectrum, I mean the ground state energy. If one excites one of these so-called fermions in the usual way, creating a particle hole oscillation excitation, one has the this kind of curve for the excitation energies, typical for one-dimensional system, and the, for very low momenta, we have a linear dispersion with a sound velocity given by usual Gross-Pitayevsky expression, and it's basically equals to Fermi velocity in the Tong-Girardot equation plus some corrections. Our aim is to calculate the same thing for spinons. There here they have this arrangement of these integers. All i's are shifted downwards by 1/2, and one introduces the new spin kind of integer j, and we're trying to and calculating the energy for this configuration and subtracting the ground state energy, one gets the excitation energy in this form. M is a, no, it's a total spin. Okay. Z is basically equals to M and my.
It's a total spin carried by this spin.
What?
No.
Yes.
What's the polynomial of a spin?
It's total spin 1, and MZ is also 1.
This is spin
wave. Yeah.
Spin on spin wave.
It's just,
people use for different.
Yeah, yes, just different times.
He chooses your spin on as well. Spin on is a spin on half object.
Oh, well, I mean, well, it's a kind of, no, but here you have a.
If you use it for spin 1, that's fine.
It's a spin 1. It's spin 1. Then. Okay. So, some calculation. Basically, okay. So, for example, in recoupling, one has to calculate the ground state energy first, and there was a kind of method which I developed to deal with this kind of Betanzas equations. I don't have sufficient time, just giving you. I mean, basically, it can be done using Bogolyubov theory, so what I said, but in order to just to check whether weak one can do better with the exact solution, one can get using some sophisticated methods the Bogolyubov development in 1D, where the ground state energy is basically proportional to the coupling, plus some non-analytic correction. This result is basically non-analytic function, and this is just the result which follows the Bogolyubov result, and it has been applied in, even in the Liebliniger paper. Yeah.
So is there a series in powers
of gamma 1/2? Yes. Sorry? No, it's not logarithmic. It's, I think it's, no, it should be gamma squared. It's 1D. It's gamma squared, and actually, there are some funny controversy. I mean, this term to calculate it from the exact solution, it took some like 40 years. It has been calculated by Takahashi in 2002, using exact solution, I mean. And the next term, there were some series of paper, and I think people still don't know exact value of the numerical coefficient. Okay, but this is just a side remark. Okay, so this is the ground state energy which can be calculated from the Betansatz. Now we take we do pretty much the same, and I don't repeat this, it's quite horrible calculations for the excited state.
That results on the small gamma, is it right?
And then one gets a result for small gamma. Okay, where a typical square root of gamma behavior, and you see that the effective mass grows, or if you wish, the coefficient in front of k square goes down. So the particle basically, the spin wave becomes slower. And it goes heavier, slower, yes, heavier. And they become heavier and then slower, and consequently slower. The same, I can give you some just. This calculation can be perfectly done by using the Bogolyubov theory and plus some second-order perturbation theory around the Gross-Pitayevsky result, which, again, I remind you, consists in that mass doesn't change. mass be equal to the bare mass. It was Jorah has remarked about the possibility to do this calculation, indeed this calculation. So basically what one has to do is basically take the bosonic operator, which is a spinner now, linearize it around the condensate phi or quasi-condensate phi. So you have two, and basically you have two components. One is close to the condensate, which is, I will call delta psi Bogolyubov. The second one is the delta psi spin. If one rewrites the equation of motion for the operator psi, in terms of this new small deviation field, and one calculates this object, which is the green function for spin waves. I'm sorry, I didn't write it. It's just green function for spin waves. One has this usual form of E minus K square, which basically here you have this same, the bare mass, plus the self-energy, and the self-energy diagram is in the first non-vanishing order is given by this kind of process that spin waves excites a Bogolyubov quasi-particle out of condensate, continues, and then reabsorbs the Bogolyubov particle. So it has, and it, I mean, just doing this calculation, one gets the same result for the effective. Okay, so as we said, the particle become heavier, and what the strong coupling limit is. Okay, ground state, well, it's kind of standard calculations, so it's just one gets the fermionic ground state energy, consisting in putting the particles on each one particle level, plus some 1 over gamma corrections. Excited state, one can see that one introduces one spin quasi-momentum lambda. It has a coupled equations for just a shift of the k's from these ground state values. Looks like that. And the punchline here is that this m over m squared, the coefficient 1 over m star, 1 over effective mass is very much reduced. And here I have kept the first finite size correction. It's either, now it depends just what is the relation between number of particles and gamma, but even in the thermodynamical limit, this term can be, is just zero, and one has 1 over gamma behavior here, which means that the effective mass is proportional to gamma because of very, very strong repartial or impenetrability of particles. I will, okay, so this is the result. Now I will just show the numerical studies. It's a logarithmic scale in gamma. So here we have the Bogolyubov kind of theory. I don't know what this one is supposed to be here. No idea. And here the Tong-Girardot result, which is 1 over gamma, basically. This is for 111 particles. So the physics of this, described by this curve, is that for small gamma, we have a, basically, we have an impurity weakly interacting with the condensate, exciting phonons and reabsorbing them back. For large, very large gamma, we have an impenetrable particle. So, for example, let's say gamma is infinity. Now we have the effective mass proportional to the total mass of the system, which means that if we try to move one particle, it pushes all the particles along. And this is what makes it so large. Yeah.
Why don't you just do a, I mean, since you know the asymptotic behavior in both both endpoints, I mean, why not do a Padé approximant and then you could get the intermediate behavior, at least the reasonable approximation of intermediate behavior analytically.
Yeah. No, that? I have never, I have no experience with Padé approximant. Wow. But you're completely right. Yeah. Okay, now, just want to this was the for more or less translation and invariant system. So now some results for the trapped system, which are as always in this kind of, it's, the trapped system is not exactly solvable. And but we can use the kind of local density or semi-classical approximation to calculate the many physical properties and in particular the excitation spectrum of such bosons in a harmonic trap.
Yeah, but in internet GA, you should be able to solve it the same way, right?
Yeah, but well, the infinite G is.
Does it do you any good?
The infinite G, of course. Yeah. Yes, infinite G is, of course.
Which?
Mass is infinite, I mean, like.
So, at least in one regime that you know some answer, may not be there.
Yeah, but for infinite system, you just say that excitations to excite this, to turn over a spin, would, doesn't cost you any energy. Yeah.
Is the SU2 symmetry of interaction important? Can you just solve the problem of one impurity in a single component system? Because the behavior basically will definitely.
You're speaking about the weak interactions.
Any interaction, just the exact solution. Just one impurity.
Yes.
I put it into single component system and see what happens. It will be quadratic dispersion relation because it's just one impurity. It will somehow interact with the rest of the system. There will be two constants, the constant which describes the interaction of
yes.
the single component and the, another constant which describes the interaction of impurity.
Yes, I guess so. I'm just asking how do you get the, how do you solve it in practice?
You solve the problem like that just by adding,
but you lose the integrability.
No, when we give the
control. I lose integrability?
Yes.
No.
That's what Maxime told me.
Yeah, yeah. You lose integrability.
Maxime.
One impurity?
Maxime.
Oh, what you said is wrong.
Okay.
So if you have a one system on a ring, yeah. Put two impurities in front of each other, delta functional impurities.
Yeah.
Then the problem remains exactly solvable.
For two, but not for one.
For one, I don't remember.
It's not. It's movable. It's an impurity which can move. It's just extra particle.
You have to move this. Yeah, you have to move this. It's dynamical impurity. It's not like
it's
boundary condition.
Just extra particle. Just extra particle.
Yeah. Well, I just don't know how to solve it. I mean, but.
So the problem becomes.
What is dynamic? You put delta functional potential.
That's an MS. Yeah, okay. In the
just to get our record straight, I think. Well, certainly, I think it has been the some Chinese couple of years ago, maybe last thing with Li, something like that. He used to be postdoc at Cincinnati, and then he has produced a paper on size solution for spin a half. For this system, I don't know whether he has analyzed the spectrum, but I seem to recall that the beta answer seemed also to go through with the interaction, spin interaction. He has a XY symmetry, i.e., that there's an anisotropy in the Z direction.
What's the name of this guy?
Lee.
The last name is Lee.
I think so. Yeah, I can look.
Yes, I mean these guys. He and his collaborators they have, presented this solution for the Bose spin one half, which I was describing here.
It wasn't the credit I was addressing. I would try. I seem to recall he has. Well, the solution also applies to the case where there is a Uliassi asymmetry in the spin space, which is conceivable because after all, you take the Kondo problem, and then you apply the Uliassi anisotropy, i.e., the spinning, the conduction direction of the spin in the z direction, not the same x y direction. That is still beta answer solvable. So if that is solvable, then you can answer the question. Suppose you have n spin. Up and then one spin, sorry, n particle up, one particle down, but then the particle interaction up and down is different from up and up. That question can have a solution if the beta answer solution can be applied to case of the spin interaction topics as well.
Okay.
Qualitatively, the physics remains the same.
No.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Okay. Okay. No, but it's a very nice discussion.
But let's see. But there's a second talk coming.
Yes. Yes, actually, I have something like 1 minute left, I'm almost finishing. Okay, so for the trap system, I'm speaking about the large gamma regime because it's somehow interesting, and the effect is more pronounced there. And we take the bosonic field and decompose it in a density, the phase related to the density, conjugated density, Z component. Here in the phase related to the Z component, and if you assume the Thomas Fermi density profile, here we can get the equation of motion for these spin degrees of freedom, like in this form. Well, it gives some peculiar equation to solve, but WKB can be. I mean, it's not kind of exactly solvable. I mean, like, it's not differential equation which one can solve. But one can use the WKB method to infer the frequencies of the spin waves in a trap. So we have basically quadratic spectrum, like in the previous case, some numerical constant. But what is important that the proportionality, I mean, the frequency is proportional to the trap frequency in the x direction, divided by gamma at the center of the trap and divided by number of particles. So we have very, very slow modes in a trap. And just this the mass enhancement manifests itself in a trap as a very slow, very small excitations frequencies. Okay, so I come to some conclusions which are more or less evident.
Is this solution consistent with the previous solutions? Suppose I think I open up the trap, so I in the strong coupling limit, I reduce to the previous solution. Because previous solution, you have 1 over n plus another one is 1 over gamma, but here you have 1 over n times 1 over gamma.
It reduces, I mean, because the first excited k, like, you know, you have this. I think it's pretty much describes pretty much the same physics. I mean, like it's you have 1 k squared over this gamma, right?
But k squared. What,
but k squared is something omega over n.
No, k squared is
an
n squared thing. The question.
Yeah, but k is has a more or less the first excited k is 2 pi divided by the size of your system, right? And the size of your system is like n. It's like to keep the density constant. It's like number of particles in the thermodynamical element.
If you are in the weak interacting regime, then this gamma zero.
Oh, this is the weak interacting regime.
No, this is a strong thing. This is strong.
This is the the physics is very simple. If you are in the weak interacting regime, Gross-Pitayevsky, then this guy is not here. And this is nothing else than the well-known result for the relative oscillations, omega squared divided by chemical potential. This is the frequency of relative oscillations for soft mode, for the relative oscillations for equal interaction constants. If you go to the strongly interacting regime, then the fact that the particles repel each other very strongly leads to the appearance of gamma here, gamma zero. Yes, it's gamma in the center. And then you get an additional, extremely large reduction. You get extremely small frequencies. But for example, if you study relative oscillations of the components in the Tonks gas.
No. I'm sufficiently loud.
This is for record.
Uh-huh. Okay. Then you have extremely small excitation frequencies, which can be, let's say, the period can be 10 seconds or 100 seconds or whatever. Yes? But otherwise, it's normal. Without gamma, it's just normal result.
No, I wasn't asking that.
Yeah.
I'm just asking, here's 1 over gamma before, but in the previous solution, 1 over gamma plus 1 over n. So.
Ah, okay.
Oh.
Yeah. But it's different.
From the product to the separation, that's all.
Here it's assumed that, that 1 over gamma is much larger than 1 over n.
Okay.
The effective mass you calculate, I the effective mass, that's for the that's the mass entering the spin wave spectrum.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess what you're saying is that if we are in a strong coupling limit, anyway, the particle distributed all all the levels below the Fermi surface, because there's a there's a Fermiization. I mean, up to the absolute value of state determinants.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So I guess the Hounsfield doesn't work in that limit. I mean, the mass increase, it means that the polarization basically in some sense is
arbitrary.
I mean, basically
right.
Become very flat.
Right,
You don't have well-defined.
I mean, just if you have the wave function which just has zero between two particles, it's basically control the spin insensitive.
Yeah,
it doesn't cost any
energy. You destroy the sort of you convert it to Fermionic picture, it's very bad.
Yeah, your wave function gets very strongly correlated.
Yeah.
I mean,
you don't need to enforce this symmetrics.
Let's see, I think we need to move on. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well, this is just some brief conclusion, but again, as I said already, mass. Very slow excitations and possible experimental application can be just detection of the strong interaction regime by and imaging the since it's very slow. I mean, it can be maybe imaged in a real time, but I haven't put the number.
Thank you.
But well, I mean, it just depends on gamma and basically what I get.
Let's thank again and then we get going on this question session.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First, if this solution you found going to remain similar when you included these asymmetric terms, yes, because the three scattering answers does have a small difference. So is that ground state? Basically, the spin polarized ground state is stable with that small term.
I think it is, but that's my recollection. But then
it depends on the interactions, and I haven't done that because I was interested in the exact solution, and these terms break the exact solution down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can be still worked. Out in the Gross-Pitayevsky regime, of course.
Yeah.
And then basically your spin waves become has just linear spectrum. And only this symmetric point they become quadratic.
Yeah, the other question is this transition to a polarized state, where does it happen at what temperature? So when you have a one-dimensional gas, when you cool it down, does it first become polarized before you enter these
Okay, that depends. Well, first of all, it depends on many processes. For example, the spin relaxation is very slow in such a gas, as far as I understand. So basically, you can cool down and get not a polarized state, but rather what Boris was mentioning, that kind of, spin with a different situation. Kind of a kind of metastable state is first. Second point is that I would expect that even if I mean just wait sufficiently long, the temperature under which I will feel the spin interruption, which you want to prefer the ferromagnetic polarized order, would be proportional to the effective exchange interaction between the spins, and that depends on the interactions. So, as far as I, well, so I would say
which are it will certainly be dependent on this effective mass.
No, he's asking, right. Have you done the finite temperature calculation for this? No. It's a very hard job to do finite temperature in Beta-Ansan.
Yes.
Another set of trick invented by Xian Yang. So.
Yeah, there is a way, basically.
There's a very sophisticated
way of doing that. But
then basically Beta-Ansatz solution becomes quite complicated because you don't have to consider, well, I was writing this equation, which it is assumed that this equation have a only real solution for this quasi-momentum. In the finite temperature, basically, can have some complex.
But in terms of physical estimates, we know that in 3D, we just need to have low enough temperatures so that the collisional volume collisional term becomes smaller as compared to this coherent term, which is responsible for these spin waves. Maybe in 1D, such a regime is just absent.
Which regime?
The regime corresponding to the spin waves in Boltzmann, three-dimensional, weakly interacting gas.
It can be, but
it's
sufficiently high temperature.
Can be there, but in my opinion, it's easy to make some estimates to check whether.
Yeah, it's easy. It's possible, but it was not the goal of this work. These high temperatures here are much less interesting than low temperatures.
No problem.
Because the problem here is.
I see.
This is polarized today.
He was just mentioning this. That's why the questions. If you would just.
Boris, I think if may. Ask everyone to continue the questions after the second talk. We need another talk, so I'd like to get things going. And I'm sure there are a lot of interesting questions. If there is a very interesting problem, and then thank you very much for attending. We can get.
I'd like to thank organizers for giving me the possibility to be here and to give a talk.
You have to be grateful to the organizers.
This is what I said.
No.